Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley, here with Lee Arkinall.
Hey everyone.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of June 24th, 2024. So Lee, I wanted to start with something that, help net security. They always kind of push out these like data gathering survey type results. And this one I kind of thought was interesting because it was titled One Out of Three Breaches Go Undetected. And so basically it's talking about what do CISOs and people feel about their tooling being able to detect a breach. And they believe a lot of it has to do with cloud complexity for some of it. They're responding to, they also talked about how it's something that they don't have full understanding or they can't validate the capability of their tools enough to feel like they're comfortable, right? And it kind of spoke to me in that level where I remember sitting in a SOC as an analyst and how, we're kind of waiting to respond for the tools to find things, and you kind of get uncomfortable when you're not getting alerted on much. You're kind of like, well, like, gosh, I feel like we should be seeing something, right? And part of you is like, oh, maybe we're so tuned that we're not, we're seeing just what we need to see. But he kind of had that uneasiness. And I think why that speaks to me now is I feel like that's what I really like about threat hunting perspective, because you have all these tools. And I mean, that's pretty good that they can sit there and 66% reliably catch everything that needs to be caught. That takes a huge load of work off your plate when you want to do like proactive threat hunting and dig into your own data and do things from that capacity, because then you're not feeling as big of a gap. But what's nice is you're actively going out there, so you kind of get that reassurance yourself, and hopefully that transitions to leadership and things as well, because you're actively looking for things. So you can say our tools aren't automatically finding things, and us, based on our strategies and our knowledge, are not finding anything. That tells a better story and kind of gives you a better sense of confidence, at least within your security program. And so, I really like when people talk about tools, because tools do great things, but it's much easier for someone to attack a tool or get around the tool because it's a static thing that people can test against, but not everyone can test it against human capability. You bring a person that is able to look at data and dig for things they understand within the data that you may have, an attacker is not going to know how that person thinks to try to circumvent those steps until they're kind of going back and forth and kind of like this like cyber knife fight perspective. So I just thought it was a really interesting article, worth bringing up, worth kind of digging into some of the metrics they have in here for people that want to read the article, just to kind of be aware of that perspective. But yeah, what were your thoughts?
So there are a couple things that my brain went to, and all of them I'm not an expert. So it's always like just questions, right? So the first thing that stuck out was that blurb right in the beginning. 7 out of 10 of CISOs believe their tools aren't as effective as they could be at detecting breaches. And the sources gave them on. My question right off the bat is why? And then, of course, sorry, side tangent, my mind goes to the atmosphere of cybersecurity solutions being sold as fix-alls, or it'll integrate directly into your environment and be successful. Almost easy button culture that some, not all, vendors pitch, right? We've seen it all. Like, this detects all ransomware. And it's like, really? Yeah. But especially ransomware, now AI being driven, whatever the case. And I remember sitting in that SOG with you. But the one thing that I thought about is whenever a CISO doesn't believe their tools are as effective, why is that? Is it because they had expectations of buying that easy button solution, or is it that he doesn't trust in the skills of the engineers that are designed to tune that or are paid to tune it, to keep it up, to the analysts that are responsible for analyzing whatever data comes out? And honestly, this is kind of where my brain stuck. I will say I got kind of stuck here. I read the rest of the article, but it was just here because This seems like a culture problem, almost. Not the one out of three goes undetected, but when you can't trust something, there's something more deep-rooted than that. Like, are you not communicating with your directors or your VPs? Are they not communicating down the chain to find out what people are doing, what their struggles are, and what the management is doing to fix those problems or get rid of those hurdles, right? Because if you can communicate clearly, granted, I will say, if this is all being done and the consensus is, yeah, we still don't feel like our traffic is, you know, we're finding this stuff, and hey, we've had pen tests and the tools missed it, you know, then that brings a different argument. But in my mind, this goes to a culture, not lack of communication, different expectations, and so on. With that tangent out of the way, I went straight to your thought too, of course, being threat hunter, is that, okay, threat hunting fills this gap to a point. Now, you know, there are some things that we can't do. Like, we look at traffic, we look at logs, we look for that stuff that the tools may have missed. But what you feel like you need is another, like, team constantly looking at vulnerabilities, almost like a bug bounty team within your organization. Because if you bring in vulnerabilities into this into the tools, and you think about CVEs and whatnot, there's just a lot of faces to this problem. And right. I just feel like there isn't one solution to it. But yeah, going back to that idea of culture being a problem, that just stuck out. Because if you can communicate clearly and say, here's what our tool's doing, here's what we expected, here's what we're doing to fill the gaps that it's not doing, or whatever the case may be, and hopefully the solution isn't bring more tools in. Hopefully the problem or the solution is training. Get your people to the skills that they need to be to solve these problems, to get the tool to where it needs to be. Then once you have that baseline, then take another assessment, right? So then you can say, okay, well, we have the tool point A, we got it to point B, improved by X amount of percent, trained up our people. Now we still have gaps, and then continue that process.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is interesting about the question itself when they talk about tools is, and yeah, I think you brought up a really good point. When people market their tools, it's stop all ransomware, stop the attack. You know, it's almost the protect phase of when you think of like Nest, right? And the question is really identify breach, and breach assumes your protections failed, but you still need to find what happened if that happens, like this circumvent your controls. So if tools really are being built for that one skew of NIST where it's just protect, and that's where they predominantly sit, then yeah, I think that's why threat hunting works really well, because threat hunting primarily focuses on post-exploitation, post-breach. So they almost feel like different skews of that, you know, model. And obviously, you know, tools can overlap into different areas, especially like, you know, talking about instant response and recover and things like that. But I also think the way the question is posed is interesting, because it's how do we know that something bad has already happened versus, you know, it's happening right now, right?
Yeah. So yeah. And one more thing that I forgot to add was the one paragraph that I really liked was 75% of respondents agree that east to west or lateral visibility is more important to cloud security than north and south. Now, I wish they'd take cloud security out of that, simply because I feel like east to west traffic, or, you know, between computers and your environment, is still more important than how, you know, the north to south. And I might anger a couple people by saying this, but north to south, I think infiltration, I think initial access and exfiltration and C2, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about the rest of the tactics, execution, persistence, defense evasion, so on, that's all inside your environment, right? Now, granted, persistent ties into C2 traffic if you got your beacon going out. And so, but I feel like I really like this paragraph. One, you know, just because I am a big advocate of having more visibility inside. It's really important to see what that adversary is doing inside of your environment versus how they got in. Leave that for root cause, assess it, improve it later on after the, you know, report. But, you know, I really agree with this paragraph. Also, Lateral visibility is lowest in the UK, 30%, which almost half report visibility in Australia and Singapore. So when we tried to get into Black Hat Europe, we gave our training last year, and we had very little traction from the threat hunting perspective. Once again, thinking about threat hunting and how it really focuses on east-west traffic or lateral traffic, there wasn't a lot of traction. Now, my concern is that, and I think these stats support that, is that they're not...
You think it has to do with privacy? Or why they're not so, they don't want so much visibility at that level?
Ooh, you're asking a question that I have no idea.
Yeah, like they have different privacy laws, right? It's, you know, when you work, so like, you know, yeah, so I wonder if that plays into like why they don't have as much tooling or data with that visibility, right?
If it does,
that's bad. It's not good.
Poses a huge risk, right?
Right.
But I guess, long story short, it appeared that that portion or that group, geographic group,
regional,
not really into threat hunting. It could be because, like you said, the all the governance and stuff. But hopefully that becomes a thing of the past, because those laws are extremely important when it comes to threat hunting, and not just threat hunting, instant response. Like, if you can't tie an investigation together because you have these regulations in your way, I mean, who's that helping? The adversary, right?
Right.
But I'll get off my soapbox.
Yeah, so an interesting perspective. I think it's worth kind of noting that, you know, this is coming from like a CISO. It's not just practitioner's level of view, right? So it's always interesting to feel like what their comfort level is and then just, you know, compare it to yours. So yeah, what do you have for us?
So I got a article from Talos Intelligence, or Cisco Talos Research Group. It's titled "Sneaky Chef Espionage Group Targets Government Agencies with Sugar Ghost and More Infection Techniques." So this is actually not really a part two, but it's the second article from Cisco Talos that focuses on the APT group known as, I just said, Sneaky Chef. Or it might not be so much Sneaky Chef, but the use of the Sugar Ghost Rat. One back in November 30th, 2023, was the first time that was seen. Right? We got Sugar Ghost Rat targets Uzbekistan government in South Korea. It uses government-themed documents as, you know, their phishing documentation. And then, you know, they saw two different infection chains. Well, what they first reported on was significant, but it wasn't really wide. The targets weren't all over the place. Now, this attack or this campaign, which was reported on June 21st, a Friday, now they're talking about, they're seeing a lot more targets. It's a much wider spread of targets, and it's still the same idea of looking for documents that look like government agencies, specifically Ministry of Foreign Affairs or embassies. And but they tweaked the infection chain a bit, where now instead of using, I believe, a standard RAR, they have an SFX script that ran, but almost the same thing, right? So this the RAR was opened. It contained a script. The script dropped a decoy document. It also dropped a loader DLL and the encrypted Sugar Ghost. So what happens is once the user opens it, the script runs. They actually, and this was actually fascinating to me, or I guess it kind of shows that I've been stuck in my ways and focusing on one thing, but of course, you know, looking through these articles, I look for terms like execution, defense evasion, persistence, etc. This persistence mechanism was actually targeting a registry key. And at first, you know, I see registry key, I automatically think the auto run registry key. Well, this one is the, and I'm going to try and, or I'll probably butcher this like crazy because it's just a random name, but or not random, but it's just a bunch of shorthand together, but it's user init MPR logon script. So I had to search, or I had to research this because I was like, I know I'm not familiar with that. Where are we at? But it's still a minor technique. It's a Windows logon script that you can put in a command. So whatever value is there, it will execute. And this execution was using Reg Server 32 to execute the DLL that was dropped with the, or out of the RAR, which decrypts the Sugar Ghost Rat, which ends up being, in this case, it was titled authz.lib or authz.lib, and then in process injects. So looking back at the other, the first article, you know, I was trying to figure out, well, how is this similar? Well, it looks very similar. Granted, I think in that case, they used RunDLL32 instead of Red Server 30, but it's still the idea of using that DLL to decrypt the payload and then, you know, them be able to do whatever they want. And, you know, going back to what the goal here is, because it was all the documentation, because of the targets, they consider this to be an espionage campaign. So it looks like they're trying to just, you know, lay in wait in different governments, get as much information as they can. But I really enjoyed the amount of details here with the targets, you know, talking about Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, India, Latvia. So a lot bigger than just Uzbekistan last time, the different tactic or TTP that was changed. Now, going back, this goes, and sorry, once again, soapbox time. But anytime I see persistence, I'm always, especially registry key, you know, my mind went straight to the auto run registry key, because that's commonly what we see. And that goes back to the idea that using the MITRE ATT&CK matrix is a great point to start your threat hunts, to start your research, investigate, read, you know, get your knowledge going. But it should not be used as a check the box for coverage. Don't get me wrong, saying, hey, we have coverage on a couple different techniques within each tactic is useful. But if you think about the different ways that it can be done, and, I mean, if you were a threat hunting team, you said, hey, we have coverage based on the persistence mechanism of auto run registry keys, and, you know, we're not really concerned about registry keys now. This is a perfect example of why you don't have full coverage for that persistence through a registry keys mechanism. So you don't want to just go through there and check the box and say we have all these gaps filled. To really research, when you can say we have these gaps filled, be confident that you are researching all these other tactics, techniques, and sub techniques, and so on. But I always love when an article gets me researching new tactics, techniques, and procedures. I mean, it improves my knowledge. But now I'm done. What's your take?
The two things you kind of touched on, obviously the registry key is always fun to find new ways to persist in registry, just because those things are kind of static in my eyes as far as that system. That's how the system works and operates. So those are the places the adversaries will use time and time again, because they really can't create new places in there, right? Unless they find a new place that the system lets them do something similar. So those are always good to be aware of and look at and be able to monitor or see if you have visibility to it at least, right? The other is the SFX. So it's interesting when you look at a SFX file because it just looks like a normal executable. But really what it does is it has the software required to decompress the content, and it also has the compressed content bundled inside of it. So they use it to get past some tooling. But in some cases, you can also pass arguments when creating an SFX file, that when it executes, it tries to run. So you can kind of have it point to other scripts or point to other types of execution and actually have no really compressed data in there. So depending on whether you have it including payloads or not, you can actually use it to facilitate execution that it's just a sneaky way. You know how people are using LNKs, the shortcut link files, to execute things because they'd have stuff in the little target path or whatever. SFX kind of has similar capability. But what's also interesting is I don't know why. I think it's a very good practice to block executables and emails and things in general so those don't go around. Granted, it doesn't mean they can't just, you know, zip this up and try to send it via compress. But that's something to look at for SFX. But one of the things, a lot of times, you know, when you think about I'm going to create an SFX file, I'm going to compress things in there. You're usually compressing a decent amount of data. So sometimes if you have visibility to file size when it comes to SFX, you might be able to identify weird executables based on that are SFX because they're really small and because they were sent without data essentially. So it's basically just like a very brief file. But Yeah, that's a technique I've seen before. I think I actually created a hunt package around that, kind of what I'm talking about, in July of 2023. So almost a full year ago, people leveraging the same characteristics as far as delivering their payloads in. I was kind of curious if it was the same, but I haven't had time to see like what my research was before compared to the people or actors in this one. But those are the two key points that I thought were really interesting about this was obviously those two things we've mentioned that are, I think, really good pieces to actually look at defending against or looking into.
Always a fan of those payloads coming out. You're next.
Yeah, so this was an article from PT Security called X-Cobalt's Go Red, the Hidden Tunnel Technique. And it's a pretty good write-up, and it talks about the Go Red tool. And it kind of, when you look at Go Red, it kind of feels like a lot of the C2 frameworks tools, like when you think about Cobalt Strike or you think about Sliver, things like that. It kind of has that feel, right? I don't know if it is designed to be managed the same way, because I think that's the advantage of Cobalt Strike is you could have a team kind of orchestrating an attack. This seems like it's not designed for that scale, but has a lot of the capabilities. And then, you know, the X Cobalt, I guess they are actually targeting against Russia, which I also thought was very interesting because you don't hear a lot of actors hitting Russia directly. At least you don't see a lot of reports about it. But they're kind of hitting all over their victimology. Metallurgy, telecommunications, mining information technology, government, software development. So you can kind of see they're across the board. But you know, what I thought was really interesting about this was they kind of walked through the capabilities, but there's some things that to note is they have a lot of tunneling, which I thought, you know, is interesting. So they use DNS and ICMP tunneling as a capability as part of the tool. And they have a couple other abilities to communicate using WSS or QUIC, QUIC. But then when looking at one of the capabilities, especially when hitting on a Unix or Linux box, which I thought was interesting because I actually did a cyber exercise, and this is something that hit us, but they modified the utilities native to the box. Specifically, they called out the PS utility. So if you use PS, it lists all the processes running on the box, right? And you can use different arguments to isolate different processes based on different criteria. But it basically is like running task lists in Windows, right? And they actually appended their little code to that to basically not display their malware implant process. It was a hard-coded name, so they can easily do this. So it wouldn't display. So if you're looking for what's running on the box, you would never see that. And they did the same thing with NetStat. So they add the code to the bottom of NetStat so that when you tried to run to see, well, what are active connections maybe going on the box, it would not display those network connections associated with the malware that's been implanted. And the exercise I was in, you know, a similar thing happened where they did that with the Who. They saw, because it was a back and forth engagement, right? They saw we were using Who to see who has an active login session on the box. Because periodically, if we saw something going on, we quickly say, okay, well, who, just get a list of, well, who's currently logged in? Like, we know who we are, who else is actually has presence here. So we know what accounts to maybe run down and you know, pivot off of. And then after a while, we start running Who because we were having some success with it and we would just see ourselves. And they did the same thing. They edited the Who utility to basically say, don't show these users when someone runs Who. It's like an inverse grep kind of thing, or yeah. And you know, it's interesting when people do that technique, because one, it didn't look like they did any time stopping here. So I thought that was interesting. And I know the all like the utilities and binaries have all the same timestamp, because they do get updated at different times with patch levels and things like that. But obviously, it would change the modification time, and a lot of people try to time stop after that so that that doesn't stand out in any way. So, you know, anytime you see a utility being mentioned when, you know, say like a touch command is being leveraged, that would be an example of potential time stopping. Just something to look into, because they're creating a fake file that looks like it, or they're actually touching the real one, and there's different ways you can modify the timestamp that way. But you know, it's a good technique to be aware of, because it is highly effective in those environments to be able to modify a lot of the native administrative utilities. And they're really easy to basically edit. I mean, you're basically just doing kind of like your typical bash scripting at the bottom of the utility while it's being executed to change those things. So that was a technique I just wanted to, you know, really highlight with this. And then the other thing I really liked about this was, and I usually don't get down to the indicator section too much, because indicators to me is just kind of a list of noise to look for, in a way, kind of how I look at it. But I always, my favorite thing when I see an indicators now is when they put file names, just because sometimes file names tell you some things as far as like, well, how are they trying to blend in? What's the intentions, or where they want these files to intentionally look like? So I have an idea of maybe how they think. And sure enough, I saw single character files, right? So I saw like a y.txt and other things like that. So going back to, hey, if you have visibility into when people make single character file types, we've been talking about this for a long time now, just having that visibility or trying to report out on that from a periodic time, then you will identify interesting or, you know, behavior that you might want to be able to explain. And in this case, you know, a fairly sophisticated kind of C2 tool, just because it likes to create files with single characters. So that's still a thing. So those are like the really two interesting things I saw. This, like, obviously it's a really cool article to walk through, because it does give you the idea of like how I would say advanced some of the C2 tools can be as far as capabilities. And they do a really good job walking out like, well, yeah, if you use this argument in the tool, it does this. If you use this argument in the tool, it does this. So you can kind of see how the tool, you know, if you're on the attacker side, how they would be leveraging it, and then what they would potentially be trying to see. But the two things that I thought were the most interesting was their way of circumventing visibility on the box by modifying the utilities, like I've seen before and was successful against us in a training exercise, as well as like the single character thing, which I think by now, hopefully people have heard enough of and hopefully care about too. So what do you think?
I don't think single character files are going away. So this was actually a pretty interesting read. I say pretty interesting, like, I'm not impressed by any of these articles that we read. I'm impressed by most of them. So one comment that I did do, I guess maybe I'm answering a question you didn't even ask, but you mentioned that it's targeting, you know, this is an article targeting Russian entities. And that was my first, like, wait, what is that? What am I reading? Yeah. So I had to figure out, I was like, okay, so who's Posit Technologies or who's PT? They're headquartered in Moscow, Russia. So That makes a lot more sense, because I think I had the same thought of you. It was like, well, why and how are we reading this? Normally, like, if it wasn't kind of aimed at the government, we probably wouldn't be hearing about it. But because it is I'm guessing... can't confirm or deny or any of these statements. But if they're their own separate entity, how they do have the visibility and the ability to speak on these attacks of organizations within Russia's borders. So that was, I guess, that kind of solves that, because I was very curious as well. So reading through, I had the same kind of feeling that this was a very advanced tool. This is a very robust piece of technology that has so many capabilities that reminded me of, and then you mentioned Cobalt Strike and Sliver. I think my mind automatically goes to Metasploit, but either way, the fact that it had, and you pointed out, and that I didn't realize it until then, until you said it, was that time stopping seemed to be the only technique that it didn't have. The only capability, yeah. Because I'm reading even at the bottom, the MITRE tech. I'm like going through and like hitting all these marks of the things I look for. And I'm like, whoa, like it's got everything. It's not just initial access. It's not. It was just pretty concerning. The one thing I was looking for, and once again, kind of stepping off the technical side, more of the intel side, if you will, I was really looking for Attribution.
So the X cobalt group, I don't know if you found the answer, but they're stemmed from the cobalt group. But I don't know if you remember Carbonac. It was like a
I
big
remember.
they yeah, so Carbonac was like the malware that really took advantage of payment systems and SWIFT, and they went after financial institution back in like 2016.
Okay.
And so really financially motivated, and that's what's kind of interesting. Obviously, I don't think it's exactly the same group and group members now. I think that's why they kind of changed the name, but it does look like they're actually going after different types of entities. I mean, we mentioned the victimology earlier, and it was a lot of different sectors that wasn't all financial. Like I think, you know, we saw information technology in there, we saw mining, software development, government. So it seemed to be, you know, almost like instead of financially motivated here, more kind of like hacktivism. You know, where like they are motivated by geopolitical specifics than they are so much financially. So that, yeah, it is very interesting.
And I will be, I guess I'll be fair on this. Russia is normally painted as the bad guy, and we like assume that everyone else around the world is playing by the rules. So seeing someone attack the bad guy, you questions raise. I think my first thought went to, is this, and probably not even close to the same thing, but you remember the group IB founder was imprisoned. My thoughts went to, is this Russian cyber criminals attacking organizations within Russia? I don't know. I don't play that game. These are just the questions that I had. But yeah, it definitely could be geopolitical activism. I don't know. I probably will not have the answers for you anytime soon. But it was
Yeah.
just interesting.
I just wish that they would push out more reports, to be honest, because it's nice to look behind like the thick curtain where we don't really know what goes on that side. We always kind of see a lot of the news stories coming from what's coming out of Russia, but not what's going in.
We
But I
see
think,
their tools and techniques.
yeah, and I think painting the whole picture really just helps, you know, people not have so much bias when it comes to attack and defense, because people will attack and defend slightly differently, and understanding, you know, both ends of the spectrum, from the like this, because like we understand cyber attacks when it comes to war, but we don't understand it to the degree on the other side of it, right? Like, so I think I'm fascinated by this as well, based on, you know, the core group and drive, and what other things are going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, there is a very quality report. It's quite long, full of technical details. And honestly, the more that we know, the better we can defend in a more efficient manner, I guess. So yeah, hit that on the head as well. And let's figure out what everyone's doing so we can defend ourselves best, not just the quote unquote bad guys.
Cool. So the next two articles I think we're going to cover are interesting, because it kind of is a little different than some of the topics we cover, and it's more about the health and welfare of people within our field, and kind of the things they are faced with. So I'll cruise through mine and kind of talk about some of the high points, and then you can kind of bring yours in, and then we can kind of talk about those together, because I think they kind of lend to a similar message, but also like a different skew of the same message. So it'll be kind of interesting how they kind of paint a broader picture there. But the first one I was going to bring up here was, it was just an article from Info Security Magazine. And it is called "Cybersecurity Burnout Costing Firms $700 plus million dollars annually." This was interesting, and you know, they were collecting data from that I guess Hack the Box ran, and then kind of did some survey-based things and looked at like when people take sick days versus loss of poor productivity, as far as days go, and based on the number of days that people were able to say, yeah, I don't work that hard because I'm kind of burnt out, or I try to take extra days because I just need the days off. They, you know, talked about how UK employers may be losing a combined of 130 million annually, and the US counterparts are like the 626 million due to loss in productivity. And some of them were interesting because they talked about 84%, they said, we're experiencing stress, fatigue, and burnout due to really the rapid pace, but also having to perform tasks outside their skill sets, like that stressor there, which is really a fascinating way to look at that. Also, they said that about three quarters of the people, part of the study, said they actually had to take time off due to work-related mental well-being problems, right? It wasn't because they just wanted a break. It wasn't anyone, but like they actually, their mental health, they feel like was deteriorating because of the stressors and things they kind of imposed within the field. Obviously, those things play a big part as far as burnout goes, but then what does your article talk about?
So mine kind of starts a couple years ago. Not a couple years ago. Let me see. Where are we at? No, yeah. My article actually starts in like 2023. So, and this is not to take shots at a certain organization. This is just a one use case that we found that has been documented on the internet quite thoroughly. So we're using that example. We are not taking shots at them at all. But I feel like it's a great example of the wellness that Scott brought to the table, which ironically, we kind of picked our articles very quickly together apart. So it was funny that we both landed on the same spot. But back in 2023, Dell had 133,000 employees, and that's pretty post-pandemic, right? So I'm sure people are working remotely, and then in February 2nd, 2024, they were down to 120,000 employees. So that's about a 13,000 employee layoff. And we know that's happening a lot. We know that a lot of organizations are laying off people, and whether it truly be behind the whole idea of we overhired during the pandemic, so we had redundancy, or we weren't really sure how it was going to work, whatever the case may be. We see that a lot in tech organizations. So the fear of being laid off once you worked, or when if you're working for one of those technology giants, I'm sure adds to the stress. Then to compound things, back in March 2024, Dell told remote workers that they were not going to be eligible for promotion unless they come back to the office or they join their hybrid kind of model. At that point, oh, and I will say I find this interesting on a point, because we've proved that, or this whole social experiment of remote working proves to work, right? We can work from home and still get stuff done. But I'll save my thoughts after we're done for this. So after they said go hybrid, or don't get promoted, a lot of people kind of stayed remote. And they were like, yeah, we really weren't concerned about promotion because either they were enjoying their jobs or they were enjoying the new work-life balance that didn't come with, commutes or being in the office. And I think if you think about like all the downtime you have in the office, like the water cooler chats, people just stopping by to ask how you're week. I mean, technically that's lost productivity. But finally, and this was on June 20th, Dell's, or the article ran, Dell said return to office or else, and nearly half of workers chose or else. So instead of going back to the office, these people were just like, all right, bring it. Like, we'll handle this whenever it comes. And they said that, they interviewed some employees and they were already looking for jobs. I'm sure once this, I can only imagine a large group of people that were working remote. As soon as this whole, you're not going to get promoted, I'm sure people started looking. You tell people they're not going to move up the ladder, or whether you're in an ambition or whatever the case may be, like people want to take their skills to the next level. People want to lead or become more technical or fill a more technical role. If you sit there and tell me come back to the office or you're going to stay stagnant, of course I'm going to start looking for another job. Are you kidding? One that'll say, hey, yeah, we'll promote you, and you can stay at home, and you'll always stay at home. I mean, come on. And we'll get into this in a second. But that's my side of the story. So Polly, go ahead.
Yeah, so especially looking at yours and I hear this from, gosh, everyone I talk to where they went to remote and there are like a lot of people being forced to come back to the office. One, I think it's okay to be asked to come back to the office if there is like a legitimate reason why things maybe aren't getting done. If you can show some sort of metric or show some sort of project or something that kind of requires that. And sure, I think it's very justifiable for businesses to take that approach. But for them just to do it because they want things back the way they used to be or whatever it is, I completely disagree. I understand they may have already paid for space and they're like paying money that no one's occupying. But that's an opportunity to figure out how to possibly save money, right? Get out of those agreements or, don't renew those agreements or whatever that, or sell the space, because if the work can be done remote, that is what it is. I think one of the larger problems with the remote workforce is, and this might, bite some people or might make me people mad at me, is ineffective management. And what do I mean by that? So an example, I remember when we had to go remote and being in security and having visibility, a lot of people, when it came to HR or managers, were always want to ask, were people actively engaged at work, trying to ask for when were people logging in, when were people logging off, were they doing like 8 to 5 exactly? And that's interesting when you see where people and managing people can't tell if their people are being productive. They either don't have the right tools to manage or they're inefficient managers, right? You should be able to know your people well enough and know what you deliver as a team, as a product or whatever, and create those milestones and have those touch-ins and touch base, whatever, to be able to do that without having to tell if someone's actually on a machine. Because we can be frank here. Some people, why they like work from home is because they can be more efficient and they don't have to work as hard to get things done, right? And I'm sure like there's going to be those episodes where, yeah, there's just some people that don't work, but that's a personality trait. That's not the risk of working remote. Those people won't get that. You don't want to micromanage people anyways if they came into the office. So, it's always going to be a burden some way. So like hats off to the people that are willing to stand their ground for this. I know it's kind of a tough place to be in. But it goes to show that there's more to a job than what you just get paid and what you specifically work on, right? And work-life balance is a really important part of that. I mean, going back to what I was talking about when it came to the burnout and not having, they really, so for instance, I went and spoke somewhere, was it last week, on threat hunting and intel and things. And I asked the question about how do you get your ROI on the training you give to people. And I use threat hunting as a great example. And I asked how many people get, training every year. Not a single person in that room raised their hand. And I kind of took a step back. Like, you guys, and they were kind of like, well, not anymore. And I'm thinking, gosh, of all the times, like, one, you should never really cut back on training. But why is that the cut now, especially if people are working remote? But also, if people are getting burnt out because they don't have the skills, and so work is harder, right? Tasks just become harder when you run into more resistance. It makes so much sense. If people aren't paying for training to get you the skills you need, then it's a sink or swim. And sink or swim is purely a burnout exercise, right? Who can tread water the longest is really what you're measuring in a sink or swim environment. And yeah, there will be people that succeed, but they may not want to work there after they succeed. They may have better opportunities because of it and leave anyways. So yeah, it's just interesting to see the two different effects that people are playing with as far as what's burning them out or what's making places not enjoyable to work. And they're both manageable. But instead of people caring about their people, they're caring about other things and using those as drivers. And people are the most important thing. We're really why people work, in my opinion, right? We show up, we create products, we do what we do to provide things and services to other people. And us as people themselves want to have jobs so we can provide for our families or ourselves in general. Like, everything we do is for people. So a lot of our decisions should be around people and not just, you know. So that's just my soapbox, really. But yeah, I don't know. What are your additional thoughts on kind of those things we've been talking about?
I've suffered from burnout as well. Multiple times. I mean, that's not something that you're going to do once and just get away with,
Especially if you're a hard worker, you kind of make yourself susceptible to it, right? You're like, yeah, I'll do it. You become like that. I can take it on. And then you're like, wow, I took on too much, right?
Yeah, right. And then you're like, well, I got to get it done. And then you get it done. You're like, oh, I need a break. And I feel like those are two different sides of the coin, though. If you're just working, and I don't mean that in a negative way at all, but if you are fulfilling your daily tasks, and the job has created or the atmosphere has made it so that that is the only thing you get done during the day, that's going to be detrimental to your health right away. Because you have no, like, if you're freaking out like, oh, you know, I have to go to the bathroom or I have to eat lunch. So you're eating lunch at your desk or you're running back and forth, you know, real quick, but you have to perform just to meet your required tasks. Like, yeah, that's going to be burnout. And I think you hit it on the head, and that was one of my, once again, two big ideas about this whole concept is that, one, if you have managers that are more babysitters or police officers trying to catch people doing the wrong thing or not at their desk, or, you know, just make sure that he sees the people versus what they're doing. Like, if he's just seeing that, if they want you to come to the office so he can see, or they can see him, know that they're in desk working, that's not good management. And you nail that. If you're not looking for what's the best position I can put my employees in so that they can succeed, they're not a good manager.
I think Steve Jobs said it best when he said, why hire a bunch of really smart people and then tell them what to do? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually just used that in a conversation I had with someone that in connection recently, because I feel the exact same way. Like, why would you hire someone for a job that you can't do yourself, then tell them how to do it? And then the second side of the coin, or the second argument, is one that drives me nuts, and I've never heard an organization come out and say it blatantly, but a lot of these big organizations and corporations have a lot of money in corporate real estate.
Yeah.
Hey, we had a 5-year deal on this office, so we have to use it. If you're good, and fine, if you want to fight that battle, go ahead. Bring your people to the office, fill that office that you, check that box and feel good about yourself. That you're going to suffer for that. Like, it's just going to happen. Putting people in a place that they don't want to be there, that alone is going to knock productivity down. I don't care how disciplined you are. I think Mike Tyson said it, that discipline is doing something you hate like you love it, which I thought was like the perfect definition.
Yeah,
I don't care how much discipline you have, you're going to burn out. If you have to pick yourself up by your bootstraps and say, I got to do this, you're not in a position to be productive or want to grow. You know, you're going to sit there and say, all right, I got to do this. I may be pulling a hair or pulling strings here, but the third to last little blurb in your article was that interestingly, 90% of CISOs globally said that they are concerned about the impact of stress, fatigue, and burnout on their security team well-being versus just 47% of CEOs. If that goes to that, if you think about CISOs, unfortunately, they're the ones that normally go after a breach and are replaced quicker than CEOs or whatever the case may be. But being in the industry, whether the CISO is highly technical or not, being able to identify that is super important. And the fact that the CEO, who is probably making these decisions, it's just like, whatever. You know, more than 50% of CEOs are like, I'm not concerned about stress.
Well, I feel like CEOs, they expect it's easy for the CISOs to find the perfect talent. And we all know in our market, finding the talent you need versus the talent you need to train are like completely different. I think CISOs are close to that understanding. So like, the reality is very different.
Right. CEOs understand business. CISOs understand the technical side of it, like but once again, culture, management, kind of people problems versus technical problems. But, you know, going through the whole Dell saga, I was like, okay, well, you know what? Let's take a look at the commercial real estate. So I guess this year it dropped down 0.8% from 2023, which the revenue is now $1.2 trillion after being down a whole 0.8%. And I looked up, and I might not be quoting the right thing, but I looked up, and where's my article? I looked up at the SEC filings of Dell. I find it. Oh, did I close it? But I think at one point it said, I'm going to check my history real quick.
While you're looking for that, I always find it interesting that what is it that filling these buildings is saving money on, other than that it looks bad when you talk to people and say we pay for all this money and no one's using it, versus, I mean, you're offsetting all the utility costs for people working at home because they're paying their own utilities. You could basically have no utility expenses running a building, or you could lease it out. I don't know, and that might be contractually. Maybe you won't be allowed to lease it out. But, you know, there's different things you could do in the building and make profits off of than it just being just a line item of expense that was just a decision that you couldn't predict. I mean, no one could predict the pandemic, so.
Yeah. No, and that's absolutely, and just think about, and being one that works remote, like, you know, I love it because I don't have to worry about a commute. You know, you're saving on gas, you're saving on, all those things, and you have peace of mind, right? If your kid's sick, you can put them in your lap or put them in a cot next to you or work from the couch versus panicking.
Yeah, then you have to call off sick.
Yeah.
Use your sick day for your kid's sick day. I mean, like, it just logistically, I just think people aren't being people when they make these decisions.
Here we go. Wall Street Journal reported, and this is in the millions, that the Dell Technologies had, where are we at? 14,324 million dollars in property and plant and equipment total. Now, I get it. The plant and equipment, right? That's a whole thing. But I think so.
Yeah, there's some jobs you have to come in for, right? It's just the way it is.
Right, right. And I mean, they manufacture. So it's going to cost. But the other property, plant, and equipment, which I'm not sure if it is office buildings. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this. But that's $5,022 million. Dollars, which what that is
like $5 billion
and possibly in corporate real estate. Like,
I mean, it's money,
yeah,
but you already spent it, in my opinion. You know, figure out how to sell it if you don't need it,
yeah, right? Like, you can gain that, but cutting 13,000 employees, probably not the answer. I understand that my salary is not how much Cyber or Intel 471 actually pays for me. Right. And everything that bundles around, you know, each full time employee could average around $1 million worth from the company. 13,000 employees, probably not going to touch that billion. You know what I mean? I don't know. I just feel like it's rough. I find it ironic that people are enjoying the work life balance more. And they're like, okay, whatever. Let's see what happens. Let's see what
Many people I've talked to, when they said that they were forced to have to go in the office with no real justification, immediately start looking for jobs or found new jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, just because, if you feel like you're a responsible human being and you're productive and you're producing, I mean, you basically take that as a bad performance review. no matter how you look at it, right?
Yeah.
So,
and last bit, I promise. I forget where I saw it. It was either on Mastodon, LinkedIn, or Twitter, one of those. But at this recruiting agency said that, I think it was a recruiting agency, said that anytime an organization starts flaunting the whole back to the office mantra, that recruitment agency finds all the employees in that organization and reaches out to them.
Oh, that's smart.
I was like, whoa, talk about like a whole, you know.
Thing. See, they understand people.
Yeah, right, right. But that's it for me.
Yeah, no, cool. Sounds like I think it's interesting to see. And it's always good to reflect on how people are working in our space. So these things are good to know. And at least talk about and think about, right? Especially when you start assessing the situations you may be in, right? But before we close out here, I want to do another plug and mention that, you know, you do have your Black Hat training, Beginner's Guide to Threat Hunting. There is still a discounted price for that. If you guys want to attend Lee's training, that discounted price ends July 19th. So try to get in there before then, so you can save yourself some monies. And with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that will close out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of June 24th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.